In this episode, the Changing Character of War program welcomes Dr. Derek Congrem, an anthropologist and archaeologist from the University of Toronto's Monk School of Global Affairs. His talk, entitled What We're Missing About the Missing, looks at the underexplored topic of missing persons in conflict and the political, judicial, and practical challenges of studying subjects we haven't yet found.
When I was first invited, I'll admit, I didn't know about the Changing Conflict of War program. So I did a bit of Googling, and I saw a lot of parallels that connected with the department that I'm a part of. I'm an anthropologist by training and by profession, archaeologist and anthropologist, biological anthropologist. But I work in the Department of Political Sciences in the School of Global Affairs at the University of Toronto, and our current director, who next year will become the next chancellor of the University of Cambridge, Stephen Toop, is a lawyer, and he wanted to make us more than kind of a traditional feeder institution to government and international organizations. He wanted to kind of more bridge the, I don't know, theoretical or perhaps real gap between theory and practice and make us more closely identifying or make help us more better integrate with professional practice. And so I'm part of that because of my professional consulting. And we're doing more kind of collaborative efforts with government and international organizations. That's kind of the direction we're headed. So I see some parallels there. I'll just give you kind of very brief overview of what I'm going to talk about. In the course of my consulting and now my research and teaching, I'm generally working on missing persons, people who go missing in the context of armed conflict. So forensic and humanitarian investigations. I'll talk about those distinctions in a bit. But there are three, in my experience in different places, three terms I think that represent the problems. I think these days in academia we're inclined to use different wording. Puzzles. I hear puzzles all the time, but what's the puzzle? I hate it. It's a problem. My mother's a social worker. She says, no, there are no problems, there are just challenges. It's a euphemism. It's awful. It's a problem. And when I think of what I do, I think about what are the problems that we have to deal with. And I think that can be summed up with mothers, methods, and mandates. And I'll spell those out as I go along. But to give you some background on the subject, when I'm talking about missing, this is a number from Lebanon, from the Civil War in Lebanon. And what's happened in Lebanon is essentially nothing. They have a president after a long period of time of kind of political kind of deadlock. But there are 17,000 at least missing, and nothing has been done on behalf of the government to search for these people. And yet the Red Cross, the International Committee of the Red Cross, is there kind of imploring the government to kind of fulfill their responsibilities to investigate. The book that I recently edited brings together 22 different authors, journalists, psychologists, criminologists, historian, biological and cultural anthropologists, who are all working in different contexts and in different elements of missing persons investigations. And although these are generally about the missing from conflict, I wanted to push the boundaries a bit. And the origin of that is from my doctoral research, which I did in Spain, on the missing from the Spanish Civil War, which has been in the press quite a lot over the past few years, but for decades after the war and during the Franco dictatorship, I mean, there was no news, no discussion about the missing. And there are over 100,000 people who were extrajudicially executed. But when I was working in Spain, you know, Spanish society has been quite divided as to, you know, whether they should look back into the past or whether they should just turn the page, all these kind of perhaps inappropriate metaphors that people use. And so Spanish society has been very divided on whether they should go back and start searching for the missing. So when I'm there as a foreigner, a lot of people would ask me, and particularly the press, because this became an angle that they liked, you know, that foreigners were interested. And for them, I suppose, the idea that a Canadian should be interested in what's happening in Spain when half of Spain wasn't concerned was interesting to them. And I would say, well, you know, I'm interested because Canada has thousands of missing people that our government won't investigate. And people were generally incredulous. And most Canadians wouldn't even agree with that statement. But the truth is, for about 150 years, there were state-sponsored and church-run residential schools for Indigenous children. and it was kind of rooted in very kind of colonial-minded racism. But as many as 6,000 children died in these schools over the span of 150 years. And when people think of Canada, they don't think about this. And when most Canadians think about Canada, it's part of this kind of, oh, it's historic. It's also a marginalized community. So most people don't care. Only very recently has the government led a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to look into that. And the Spaniards found that kind of confounding, that, you know, that Canada and Canadians should be interested in this. And I would say, we're not doing anything in Canada about it. So I'm looking to where things are happening to see what we can learn from you. And that was intriguing to them. But it also allows me to kind of push the definitions of who's missing. And I also include in the book a chapter by someone who works in a museum where they curate and sometimes display the remains of indigenous persons, remains that were collected in the name of science. This is something that, as an archaeologist and biological anthropologist, we're really having to confront, not having to confront, we ought to have confronted it much, you know, a long time ago. But kind of social awareness, again, of marginalized communities has changed and of their political power. And even here at the University of Oxford in the Pitt Rivers Museum, I was there yesterday, took this image of all these crania. And I wonder, you know, who asked these communities, or did anyone? One of my research colleagues, his six-year-old, was taken to a museum in Toronto, and she said, "But Dad, all these things are so beautiful and so interesting. How did the museum get them to agree to give these things up?" He said, "What a brilliant question from a six-year-old." Because there was generally no agreement. These things were taken. And so I wanted to explore the idea of, are these missing persons? Are these victims of enforced disappearance? Because there are repatriation claims from Canadian Indigenous groups for remains like this. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm just really going to stick to those who go missing in armed conflict. And contemporary investigations are very much, they very much begin, I suppose, with Argentina. And this phrase in the image, aparición con vida, appearance alive, became a sort of mantra, and it's been continued and echoed today in modern-day Mexico, where 43 student teachers went missing. At the hands of the government, they were detained, and they disappeared. And a lot of media attention, public pressure has gone in, but none of those 43 have been found. And the expression when protests are being staged, and you see it all over Mexico City, I was there for a conference last week, you see 43, and you hear people chanting, vivos se los llevaron, vivos los queremos, which means they were taken away alive, and we want them back alive. Now, when we talk about missing persons, it's generally a horrible euphemism, because there's a belief that's quite reliable that odds are these people are dead. But until there's some sort of physical evidence, we can't believe it. And how can I tell a mother who's searching for her son or her husband that, oh, you know what? They're probably dead. So you know, don't give up on that idea. The International Committee of the Red Cross in Bosnia wanted to resolve questions for wives, mothers of missing people. Wanted to help them with issues of inheritance and things like that, because with this ambiguous status of missing, there's no kind of legal resolution for a lot of problems that exist. So the ICRC started to coordinate the issuing of death certificates for the missing. They thought that this would help families, and in some respects it does, but so many families were horrified by this. They clung to a belief that they're missing, but they're not dead. They're being held in prisons in Serbia. In Kosovo, the same thing. The same belief was held by Albanian Kosovars that, oh, our missing are being held in prisons in Serbia, and by Kosovar Serbs, our missing are being held in Albania. For a period of time, it's possible that that was true. In general, we know now, because of exhaustive investigations, no, they were dead. Families of Americans who went missing in action, soldiers in Vietnam, still to this day believe they can go to Vietnam as a tourist. They can search the whole country. The United States Department of Defense spends, on the books, $100 million a year, but its recent audit showed that it was probably closer to $200 million a year, searching for missing combatants from Korea, World War II, and the war in Southeast Asia. But families, American families of missing in action, soldiers still believe, some of them, a minority, but they're still being held prisoner somewhere in clandestine prisons. It's really awful to be kind of confronting this, and I can't, I had Mexican mothers come and say, oh, we're going to dig, we're going to search for remains, we're going to do some exhumations next week, because the government won't do it. Will you come and help us? I didn't want to tell them, oh, I've got to talk in Oxford, I really can't. I mean, it sounds awful. I said, well, let me see what I can do, if I can kind of help connect you with some people who are in the country. But it's interesting, I'll kind of develop this a little more, that we've seen this sort of evolution, adaptation, transference from one context to the next. So moving from Argentina to Spain. Even though the crimes committed in Spain happened decades previously, this was kind of what was happening, this silence, silencio, mass graves. But over time, and especially since the year 2000, there's been a change in the social memory, social consciousness, the fading of the dictator Franco, and in his absence come up his victims, the victims of his army and the dictatorship. In Iraq in 2003, the American-led campaign, under the guise of looking for weapons of mass destruction, went in and took out the Ba'ath Party regime. And as soon as that regime fell, families rushed out. People were missing, but in many instances, they knew where those people were. They were being detained at a military base or in a prison, notorious prisons, not unlike Syria. And people came to the belief that they were dead and buried, but couldn't search, weren't allowed to search. As soon as that regime crumbled, they went out and started digging them up with mechanized backhoes, and this was the result. And for the American administration in particular, also the British, this was a problem. As they failed to find weapons of mass destruction, they thought, politically, this could be very valuable. But when excavations and investigations are held like this by desperate families, and there are some images of soldiers kind of standing by, international soldiers, and watching, because they're standing between desperate mothers or families, and the desire to be able to use that evidence of past crimes by a previous regime. This was done by the Nazis in 1943 in Belarusia, Poland, the Ukraine. They conducted some remarkable forensic investigations of mass graves of victims of the NKVD, the Soviets. And they used it as a way of saying, look, you can trust us. Look at what the previous administration did to your people. You can trust us, and we know how that worked out. So there's a real political interest in controlled excavations. And eventually there were, both my wife and I were involved in investigations for the U.S. Department of Justice in Iraq. But there were others, colleagues of ours and dear friends, who said, no, it's too political, it's too one-sided, and they're right. You know, we have to balance kind of questions like this. I'll just give you a brief, kind of develop this idea of the transnational discourse on the missing and universal jurisdiction. It's one of the chapters in the book written by two Spaniards, a journalist and a social anthropologist. And they talk about how Spanish investigative judge Baltasar Garzón indicted Augusto Pinochet when he came to the UK for back surgery. He was out of power, and Garzón said there are 30-some Spaniards who died, Spanish citizens who died under the Pinochet regime or went missing. And under the guise of universal jurisdiction, I want to investigate this case. If the Chilean government won't, I will. And it became a big deal. I mean, if you were in the UK at the time, I'm sure you saw and knew all about it. And Maggie Thatcher intervened and said, no, Mr. Pinochet goes home. We do not extradite him to Spain. And Garzón lost that battle. But then in Spain, it created this awareness. People started to say, well, wait a minute. Because people were proud of it. They were excited. Yeah, we're going to go after these dictators, right? Thinking in a perhaps post-colonial way, the former colonies, they're a mess, we need to help sort them out. But then Spaniards started to say, but wait a minute, what about our dictatorship? What about our regime? Okay, it's been a couple of decades since, but we've done nothing with over 100,000 missing people who have been extrajudicially executed. These are not battle casualties. These are people who were taken from their homes at night, executed, and made to disappear. And a lot of people knew where they were, but they never spoke of it. In 2008, Baltasar Garzón took up the case, and he said, I'm investigating 20 different officials from the war, from the dictatorship, who I think have committed crimes. And his argument was, with missing persons, it's an ongoing crime. until we know where those people are, until we know what happened to them, for sure, by a legal standard of knowledge, it's an ongoing crime, and the families continue to be victimized. And this resonated with a lot of people. It excited. There were civil society organizations that were going out and digging up bodies. One of the authors of the chapter that I mentioned, he started it. He went looking for his grandfather. And he found him. He just put an ad in the local paper, said, "I'm looking for my grandfather. He disappeared on this date in 1936. I understand he's buried near a ditch somewhere near this town. Can you help me?" People came forward. They went out, hired a mechanical excavator. Some scientists volunteered. The government didn't want to touch it. They found 13 people in a mass grave, one of which was his grandfather. He identified him by a ring and a gold tooth. He paid for DNA sampling. And he was immediately flooded with phone calls from other Spaniards saying, yeah, help us do that too. And Spaniards said, "Why are we so concerned with those dictators when we've got so many missing here?" Now, Garzón lost his appeal to pursue this investigation, but it was in part because he had, in another case, authorized illegal wiretaps. And so he was basically removed from the bench and then became a consultant to the International Criminal Court. But then, in a sort of ironic twist, an Argentine judge, some Argentines who were the children and grandchildren of victims from Spain. Their families had fled the war and the dictatorship, sought refuge in Argentina, nationalized the next generation, and they made an appeal to an Argentine judge, universal jurisdiction, help us investigate the disappearance of our parents and grandparents in Spain. So this judge, Servini de Cubría, took up the case, made an appeal to the Spanish judiciary, and it's still ongoing. But the Spanish government authorized exhumations in Spain on behalf of the Argentine judge. They wouldn't do it for their own judge, but they did it for the Argentine judge. This comic, I love this cartoonist, Orellana Maufin, and it just represents what's happening. These mass graves in Spain migrating across the globe and being opened up, discovered in Argentina. There's a really interesting, when I talked about the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina, there's also a grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo. And they're looking for their daughters who were detained while pregnant by the Argentine government. And there's a belief that there were about 500 cases like this. There's a belief that the babies were born while the woman was incarcerated, that the babies were given up to military families, forced adoptions, and then the mothers were executed. So the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo, that's their main agenda, to find their biological grandchildren. And one Argentine said, here in Argentina, the grandmothers search for their grandchildren. And the Republican grandchildren, Spanish Republican grandchildren, we search for our grandparents. It's the other way around. Really interesting connection. Again, just more kind of illustrations. This is the Argentine judge banging on the... Because in Spain, they would argue there's an amnesty law. And we know international law and so on. And Garzón argued vigorously against the amnesty doesn't count. It doesn't apply in these cases. Or it's illegal, right, according to international law. Ascensión Mendieta is an Argentine in her 90s. She was one of those who made the plea to the Argentine judge. And just recently, in January, her father was exhumed from a cemetery by an NGO. So Spanish officials conceded to the exhumation, but Spanish forensic practitioners were not permitted to participate. It's a strange kind of game that the Spanish government is playing. And he was buried with 22 others in a cemetery. So it was a mass grave and victim buried on top of victim. And they DNA identified her father. And her whole idea was, I want to be buried with my father's remains. Not in a plot with no name. Unmarked plot. This brings me to the idea, why do we care about the dead? This headline came out in August in Al Jazeera. Syrian rebels shot down a Russian helicopter. You might remember this. And allegedly had the bodies. I don't know how this played out. But had the bodies of the crew from the helicopter. And we know, certainly in Canada, I presume in the UK, the value of a dead soldier's body. Right? It's played out a lot. It has a tremendous kind of social value to us. Whereas, well... I'll leave it at that. But they wanted to exchange them for living prisoners, kind of their allies, their associates. So it's really interesting, the kind of the political value that's being played here. But why do we care about the dead? I mean, it's captured in the Geneva Conventions and additional protocols. I'll develop that a little more later, about government obligations to mark burial sites, to investigate, to inform families of the missing, of the status of the investigation, of the whereabouts of those who have gone missing and have died. In the United States, I mean, I grew up on the border with the United States and then later went to work for the U.S. Department of Defense. They have a lab in Hawaii, made reference to it earlier, and they're just continually sending teams to Europe, to Vietnam, to Korea, to search for those missing soldiers. This flag is the only flag that routinely flies over the White House, other than the American flag. And it's of the POW-MIA movement. I mean, it's a movement. There's no particular group that is represented by this flag. It shows an image of a young soldier. It's a profile, kind of a brush cut. And there's a tower, kind of a watchtower in the background, and barbed wire around. It's this idea that these people are still alive and need to be rescued. They're missing in action. They're not dead. But of course, the government generally believes that they're almost all certainly dead. But until they come back with those remains, people won't be convinced. And it's tremendous political clout, this idea, until they are home. This is the kind of phrase that is associated with the POW-MIA movement. And even in some instances, so I worked in the laboratory, and the laboratory argued, look, we're spending millions of dollars going to Vietnam, and seldom do we find remains. They died in jet crashes. It's very acidic soil. The Vietnamese weren't performing funerals for the pilots that were bombing their villages. Should we be surprised by this? No. So the lab said, do you want bodies? Do you want IDs? Because 15 kilometers down the road from the lab is a cemetery, a war cemetery, with all kinds of burials of unknown soldiers. We think we can figure out who those people are. Do you want bodies? Do you want identifications? Because Congress said we need 200 IDs a year, 200 identified bodies a year. So historians with the Department of Defense started to look into the archives and say, well, you know what? I think this guy is Mr. X or Captain whatever. And so in the lab management, they said, okay, give me a list of all potential candidates, give me a sense of the probability of who it is, and then we can convince the military to grant permission to exhume, because the military does not. Pearl Harbor, the ships that went down, it's a sacred place. So just outside the lab is Pearl Harbor. Those sailors that lie in their ships go untouched. But it's because they're home, in a certain way of thinking. Another chapter in the book is by a Guatemalan psychologist, but she's also indigenous Maya, Maya Achi. And she says, according to Maya cosmology, when people die, when Maya die, they don't die. Their physical body or their physical self, their self transforms, and they become embodied in a spirit. And that spirit protects the region, ancestral lands. But they can't make that transition successfully unless the body is accompanied to a cemetery and proper rites are held. When, during the Civil War in Guatemala, when so many indigenous communities were devastated, mostly men, but a lot of women and children as well, were forced into disappearance, for the Maya, they can't make that transition. Without a body, without those rites, without that transition, they're stuck in sort of an odd kind of state. They don't know how to explain the presence. And the chapter talks about how the families of the missing communicate with the missing who are in distress through their dreams. It's really remarkable. And the argument I make is, look, we can't help these people unless we understand how they understand the situation, the problem. But there's still this need, psychological need, to recover the missing members. And another quote from an Argentine, it's in Spanish, I'll translate it, but she says, mis tíos abuelos están ya en su lugar, pero mi tío no. 5 members of her family, 3 great uncles, an uncle, and I think her father or her grandfather, were all killed during the Civil War or in the dictatorship. And she says, my great uncles, they're already in their place because civil groups found their bodies and identified them. And this idea that they're in their place, because the place where they were dead and buried wasn't their place, right? It was unacceptable to her, because family should have the right to decide where they lie. But she's still looking for one uncle. He's still not in his place. Really interesting conception. So I'll get now to the three M's. I was going to call this the three M, the mothers, methods, and mandates, but I thought I might run into trouble with intellectual property rights, and I have no financial interest to disclose, so I'm just not going to use an acronym. It's mothers, methods, and mandates. One quick story, not two, to exemplify this situation. I was in Kosovo. It was only my second year doing forensic work, and a lot of victims were buried in the yards of their homes. So we'd go in to investigate. Yellow crime scene tape would be put up. We're familiar with this from TV. And the idea, really, in theory certainly, is to prevent contamination of the evidence. But I think in this context, it was really much more as a way of distancing ourselves as scientific practitioners from the families. The idea that we would be subdued to psychological harm or stress if we were interacting with them directly. And this is very different from how things happened in Argentina, where the mothers and grandmothers were protesting. The mothers and grandmothers were at the graveside during the first exhumations. They were protagonists, they were participants, they were side by side. In Guatemala, it's the same thing. Remote indigenous communities with the families helping excavate. I was giving testimony at the International Criminal Court in a trial recently. I'll tell the story later in question time if we have time. I just don't want to run over time. But the defense counsel was asking me questions about methods. We had the yellow tape, but there were a couple of locals who were inside the tape. We videotaped all of the investigation for the benefit of the defense. And some of that was played back in court. And so the defense counsel was asking me during cross-examination, you know, really, is this normal? Is this acceptable? We went back and forth for about a day on that and related matters. But I explained to him, actually, this is normal practice in a lot of countries, that the families are integrated in the process. And I'll go back to this with mandates. One other quick story, also in Kosovo. We went, in part of investigations, we had the authority, legal authority, to go and exhume whoever we decided needed to be investigated. But someone in their great wisdom said, let's ask for permission from the families. In one particular instance, I went with an investigator and a translator. We went to ask for permission from a couple whose children had been executed. We explained who we were, what we were doing. It was a father and a mother. And the mother kind of stood behind the father. And the father said, but why? Why do you want to do this? And the investigator, a bit agitated, we're all foreigners and we're really believing in what we're doing. We're bringing justice to these people. He said, we want to try Slobodan Milosevic and the military generals and the heads who were responsible for these massacres. We want to bring them to trial and put them in jail. And the father said, what about the police officer who executed my children in front of my wife and I? The investigator kind of thrown off. He got a bit defensive and he said, oh, well, that's a matter for the Kosovar courts. You have to know that at that time the infrastructure was wrecked. There were no Kosovar courts. But it was the plan to take the heads of military, state, to trial and establish courts, eventually, to try the small fish, so to speak. The father said, he's still a police officer in this town. Very awkward moment. The investigator tried to argue for a bit, and the father said, no, you can't exhume my children. Go away. And it was a really stark kind of awakening where I thought, we came in with this idea of bringing justice to these people, and we're doing further harm to the primary stakeholders of this process. So I tie in with his mothers. In some countries, they're working directly with them. In some countries, they're in the sidelines, the Argentine mothers. They're sometimes primary victims, secondary victims, but they're often culturally represented as vulnerable. The Argentine government was kind of casting them as las locas, the crazies. You know, there's something wrong with them. They're protesting. They don't know what they're talking about. Their children were guerrillas. They died in battle. It's that simple. But of course, they won the day. It's hard for police and military to take on 50-year-old women with white handkerchiefs on their heads, right? How do you justify physical violence against them? Some of them were assassinated. But eventually, they won the day. We see similar organizations with the Mothers of Srebrenica and in Liberia, where women are kind of becoming powerful political agents. I was working with the Argentine forensic anthropology team in Africa when this news came out that one of the pregnant mothers who was detained in Argentina survived. She gave birth in prison. She was allowed to leave and told never to speak of it again. Her son, her baby, was given up to a military family. For decades, she didn't talk about it. Until her son had doubts about his parents. They were military, or the father was in the military. And it was in the news a lot that this had happened. And he went and gave DNA. And his mother, his biological mother, decided she would also give her DNA. They were analyzed, and they were linked. Biological mother, who survived, she was detained but survived, met her son. And this is all because of these mothers' organizations that are coordinating this, campaigning, publicity, paying for DNA tests. And in Spain, and this image is from the press, so it's not, you know, it might be biased. And these are the daughters and granddaughters. But you see that women are heavily represented in these public protests. In this particular instance, it was protesting the removal of Baltasar Garzón from the legal case, holding up signs or images of their fathers and grandfathers who are missing. I'm going to move into methods now, which has been a focus of my own research, and it's the product of frustration from failed searches. Because the typical method, how do we find the missing? Well, you go and you ask around, where are people buried? It worked in Spain with the first exhumations. And it works in most places, up to a certain point. You ask around, people say dig there, you find bodies, great. But in some instances, most instances, we look at Bosnia, 20 years, hundreds of millions of dollars invested, perhaps the most advanced DNA lab in the world, international experts from all over, the tribunal investing heavily in investigations. And just from Srebrenica alone, when there were up to 8,000 men and boys who went missing, there are still 1,000 missing. It's 1 out of 8 with all that effort. And we know about Rwanda, right? With 500 to 800,000, we can't even get a good idea of the number of missing. 2 mass graves have been excavated. That's it. Nah, there are different reasons for that. But there are clearly limits on these kind of methods that we currently employ around the world. So I started to look in, well, what other kind of sources of information can we get? This image is from 1977. It was declassified by the United States government, and it's of a military base in Argentina. Satellite image from 1977, it's pretty clear. And they were looking for a mass grave. This was only a couple of years ago. I thought, wow, that's great. And we always knew, generally we know that the US government had this, but when I was with the US Department of Defense, I couldn't get my hands on these images. I was a foreigner. And I would argue, but I'm here, I'm doing research, I'm working for you. They said, no, sorry, classified. Okay, great, thanks. Then, and this was the kicker, this image is from 1945. I was in this field with a team from the US Department of Defense, and we were digging here where this red arrow is. We were looking for a pilot who was on a bombing mission, his plane got shot down, crashed in Germany. Witnesses said, oh no, the plane crashed here. Single pilot in the plane. We found this big crater. That's usually a good sign. That's where the plane crashed, things blew up. That's where you find the pilot, typically. We only had maybe a week left. We weren't finding anything. Lots of kind of metal, scrap metal, a few pieces of plane, not much. A German comes walking down the road here, and he says to me, I think you're digging in the wrong place. Oh, great, like I haven't heard that before. And like I don't believe that because we've been digging here for 3 weeks. I kind of had this sense. And he said, and I said, what makes you think that? He says, look at this image. Where'd you get that? And he says, I think you need to be digging 30 meters over there. Here. I said, I think you're right. He got this image from a U.S. Army Air Force archive here in Britain. I thought, how can the U.S. Department of Defense not come up with this image? Some local German does? He was on vacation in the U.K. and he knew about this archive. And he said, I wonder what happened in my local community, you know, around the time of the end of the war. We found the pilot. It just goes to show this exists, but we seldom tap into it. And this kind of triggered my PhD research, which was spatial analysis and modeling of burial site locations. I thought, is there a way to kind of give a test to oral testimony? Because with oral testimony, it could be true and accurate, precise. It can be that the person believes they're telling the truth and that they know exactly what happened. I had so many Vietnamese people tell me, we buried him 1 meter deep, we had a little funeral ceremony, he's right here. And we dig and there's nothing. We dig and there's nothing. Are you sure? I swear. Okay. They In some instances, they probably believed they were telling the truth, but memory, you know, especially after so many years, a traumatic event, a jet crashing into their village. And then in other instances, they lie. But I can't tell up front. I try, but I'm not good at judging, is this the truth? Is this something they believe to be the truth but are mistaken about, or is this a lie? So I say, can we come up with something that will help corroborate or refute oral testimony? This is kind of a brief, some of the theoretical underpinnings. Talk about spatial autocorrelation. I'll show an image that helps illustrate this. What it is in geography, it means that the location of one thing impacts the location of other things. Spatial relationships and characteristics impact one another. I'm currently based in Costa Rica. Where you grow coffee, coffee grows best where there are other types of shady trees. So flourishing coffee is related, spatially correlated, with the presence of shaded trees. And this is what spatial autocorrelation is about. But we see it in ecology, geography, culture. That maybe we can use this to help us find things. Behavioral decisions are particularly restricted in times of war. This is an assumption I'm making. Say, fewer resources, limited territory and security. You've got dead bodies, what do you do with them? Your options are limited. Stathis Kalyvas talks about rational choice theory. I mean, I say rational choice theory, and he talks about the logic of violence in civil war. He uses it to say, how do occupiers calculate who to kill? Who's the enemy? I thought, wow, can we extend this now to say, once they've identified who their enemy is, what do they do with their bodies? And then the hypothesis that I came up with, I said, well, look, resources are limited, people are making rational decisions. We always characterize these contexts with, you know, psychopathology, right? So I'm almost saying, oh, he's a madman. He's very calculating. I mean, we know this inherently. There's a bit of, I think, psychopathology, of course. But generally, when it comes to body disposal, especially in criminal contexts, it's a lot of rational decisions being made. And it produces spatial patterns of body disposal. The null hypothesis is that grave locations are random. And this is an argument in Spain. They say, oh, the killings, they're random. It was anarchy. Well, I'm looking to test this assumption. This map was produced as evidence in the Mladic trial in the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. It's difficult to see, but there are red triangles that represent schools and red circles that represent mass execution and burial sites. What's the relationship between schools? And they detained thousands of people over several days. Where could they possibly detain these people before they executed them? Schools. Schools weren't in. The war was going on. Once they killed them, or they had to transport groups, hundreds of people, they weren't going to take them far, right? So if you're looking for mass burial sites, where are the schools? Right, we know this now in hindsight, but there are still 1,000 missing. So what are we missing? Can we use these sorts of information to draw inferences about where further bodies are buried? A colleague and I did an analysis, a spatial analysis, of the location of primary and secondary burial sites, very briefly. Primary burial sites are where bodies were buried originally, often where they were executed. 2 months after they were executed in Srebrenica, the U.S. State Department released aerial images showing heavy machinery working. People were still saying, where are the missing from Srebrenica? And they said, we see all kinds of activity and disturbances in the ground from these images. We believe they've been killed and buried. Over the next 2 months, the Bosnian Serb army went to the primary burial sites, used mechanical excavators, dug up bodies, and relocated them. The orange points represent the primary mass grave sites. Orange dots. And the green dots represent the secondary, so the second burial place. We just did a simple test called Morin's Eye to show, is the relationship, is the spatial positioning of these, is it random? And the reason this is important, I mean, it shows a less than 1% probability, and we know this intuitively. But this can be important because we're talking about crimes against humanity and genocide, things that are systematic, organized, coordinated. It's not anarchic. It's not thousands of individual homicides. This is something that's organized. And it helps us not only understand the crime, but in resolving the fate of the missing. I did a study, a couple graphs, I won't go into detail, in Spain. So I wanted to create a model contrasting, I used known burial sites where people had been identified, And I created random sites, which are called non-sites, to create two contrasting groups. Using logistic regression, create an algorithm, and it creates this projection across the map that says these are the types of locations where you find burials, these are the types of locations where you don't find burials. I thought this might be useful, so if you have a witness saying, oh no, they were taken in that direction and buried so here, and another one saying, no, they were taken over there, and you can look at this map and say, you know what, that's not the type of place where we see people being buried, but that is, where do we start digging? So it could be, you know, something that helps guide. I was talking with Annette about this briefly at lunch. I looked at how far people were being taken from the point of detention to their murder and burial site. And what this means is how many towns did they cross during that journey from detention to death and burial? The average is one. They crossed over into the next administration. 75% of cases, one or two towns. They're removing victims from their own community and dropping them off in the next community. This is a graph showing the density change from the place where the person was detained to where they were buried. The density, it's not a tight correlation, but it's dropping. They're taking them to other municipalities, other jurisdictions, and they're taking them to less populated areas. These are all kind of logical things, but we've never really given them the test. But in Spain, it was non-combatants. North Korea, I just show a couple of images. It's kind of limited data and ability to speak in North Korea. The Americans went in 2001, and they had a historian find this image from 1950. It's post-battlefield, bodies lying on the ground. They said, where are we going to look for these bodies? The North Korean government gave permission to the American military to go in and search for bodies. They kept them on a camp, barbed wire facing in, very limited. But they wanted to do as much work as possible, and it was something that I was working on. Before we get there, where do we look? And they looked where the bodies were lying on the ground, and that's where they found them. And this is very common with combatants in this kind of context. Where they die, there they lie. Sort of probably perhaps an inappropriate kind of phrasing, but that's pretty common. But when we compare them in the same context, combatants and non-combatants, this is from Cyprus, from Greek Cypriot victims, don't have access to the Turkish Cypriot victims yet. I say yet, it's kind of a hope. But there were two phases in 1974. The first campaign, invasion from the north, the size of the circle represents the numbers of victims. So we correlate where people went missing, the type of victim. Green is combatants, blue is civilians. And we see temporal patterns, spatial patterns. We start to understand the politics and the logistics of killing and burial. Combatants overwhelmingly buried where they died. Civilians, not so much. Removed from their communities, taken away. Buried elsewhere. And the killings occurred in two kind of different months, different phases. So it tells us a bit about kind of those who were conducting operations and perhaps why they treat combatants and non-combatants differently. Mandates, the last M. And I'm going to kind of evoke fewer answers and more questions here. But there's this question of whether or not we should exhume in the first place. Certainly with Jewish victims from World War II, been a lot of objection from the Jewish community. If they're objecting, there's kind of an Orthodox tradition, generally an Orthodox belief that that's disturbing the spirits of the dead. But in Poland right now, there's a community that's strongly advocating the exhumation of a grave. They want to demonstrate that they weren't responsible, that it was the Nazis that did it. And the Jewish community, the descendant community, is saying, don't touch it. We don't want it. The mothers of the Plaza de Mayo split. One group saying, we want exhumations, and the other group, the Asociación Madres, saying, when you exhume a body and return it to a family, they stop campaigning. Their militancy stops. They don't care anymore. We want full justice, full accounting, confessions, sentences of everybody. And until we have all those things, we don't want the bodies. Really contrasting opinions. There's this question of, do exhumations placate calls for fuller justice that comes from that in Argentina, and we've seen it elsewhere. And then there's the question, it's a bit of a trope, I guess, justice or peace and transitional justice. Do exhumations provoke unrest, further continued conflict? Certainly it sends people into hiding, those responsible. Whereas in South Africa, we see kind of a confessional model of kind of transitional justice, truth and reconciliation. And there's a lot of debate about whether that's... There's not much evidence to suggest that exhumations in fact provoke further conflict, but it's used often, particularly by politicians and people who are well connected to those responsible for the deaths and the disappearances. Coming to the end, humanitarian or forensic, this is sort of a false dichotomy or perhaps a bad practice, bad habit. The Yugoslav tribunal was interested not in which individuals died, but how many Muslims died. How many Orthodox died? They're thinking about crimes against humanity and genocide. They're not thinking about murders. They're not thinking about, should we DNA test this person, try and figure out who they are so we can send those remains back? They're really interested in a legal case to try their heads. And I talked about the problems of that. The International Committee of the Red Cross, on the other hand, is neutral, humanitarian. They don't cooperate. That's not how they work. When they exhume bodies, they don't technically exhume bodies. They encourage governments to fulfill their obligations to investigate. When governments investigate, the ICRC can help facilitate the analysis of those remains for the identification, but they won't say a word about the cause of death. They're worried that that will be used in criminal cases, and they can't participate in that. That's their mandate. So in the literature, you see this dichotomy. But of course, humanitarian elements are part of justice. It may not be criminal justice, it's more social justice. These things are not as separate as they're, sometimes it works that way. In Kosovo, right after the conflict ended, NATO sent in gratis forensic teams. Got a Canadian team, British team, American team. They're all doing forensic work on behalf of ICTY. But a few months later, ICTY says, no, we're ready, we can do this now. We're going to do it on our own. Multinational teams, some gratis teams incorporated in, others, the British and Americans, continue to operate independently. The British all got OBEs. And a couple years later, we kind of lost interest, the international community. We walked away. That's an exaggeration. But the United Nations mission in Kosovo set up an Office of Missing Persons and Forensics, and they were interested in forensics and humanitarian mandate. So there was an evolution. In Iraq, I talked about the ethics and the political influence of scope. We're only looking for victims of the Ba'ath Party regime. Anyone who died post-2003... it's not our interest. We're not looking into that. That's problematic. It is problematic. It's not a, I shouldn't use the past tense. The ICRC since 2003 has developed this thing called humanitarian forensic action. They're incorporating the two words in one, but they're still only pushing a humanitarian mandate. But in international humanitarian law, the obligation to search for the dead, maintain their dignity, the right to know, all these things. So then, just as I kind of wrap up here, think about the future. And what does this mean? There's a mandate clash. I think of Georgia. The International Criminal Court has been asked by the Georgian government to investigate. It started preliminary investigations. I've worked for the ICRC, and part of this is personal. It's personally motivated. I'd love to hear from some of you to say, oh, there's a parallel in these countries where there were mandate clashes, organizational conflicts, and this is how we resolved it. I say, great, let's copy-paste. Because I consult to the International Criminal Court and the Red Cross, and they're both in Georgia. And they're both collecting information on missing persons, and they won't share it. And I think, well, who are they serving here? They're both serving families, but in their own way, and if they're not collaborating, what's the problem? What's gonna happen? And with complementarity, the principle of complementarity between the International Criminal Court and the Georgian government, we might see conflicts, and it's complementary, right, in theory. I'm not sure in practice, we'll see. In Colombia, I was really hoping for a yes vote on this plebiscite. And one, because I know a lot of Colombians who were on the side of the yes. They wanted this peace deal to be formalized. But obviously a lot of people didn't. They didn't agree with the agreement. And they rejected it by the narrowest of margins. But the ICRC was expected to lead the process here in finding the missing. But people rejected this idea that there would be immunity for some people responsible for crimes. The government has a Justicia en Paz legislation, which, Justice and Peace, which has kind of a limited criminal investigative mandate, but it's really more, it's also humanitarian. So there's some tricky kind of games being played about, what should happen. And I throw in this last bit, the Commission for International Justice and Accountability. I don't know if you know about this. Bill Wiley is behind it, and it's, I don't know if technically it's an NGO, it's NGO-ish, but it's really the result of frustrated attempts of working with organizations like ICTY, the Criminal Tribunal in Yugoslavia, and the ICC. and saying, oh, they're so scared about security and they won't go in. So this CIGA is using people in Syria to confiscate documents and information and testimony and smuggle it out of the country, and they're sharing it with governments that are interested. How they decide who to share this information with, I don't know. 4 days ago, the Canadian Minister of Foreign Affairs announced, you know, he, in front of the prosecutor, chief prosecutor for the ICC, said Canada's supporting the ICC and supporting CIGA, which has kept a very low profile until now. I mean, it's kind of like private intelligence gathering. Maybe this isn't new, but for its implications of missing persons and forensic investigations, for me, it's a bit upsetting. There's a lot of unknowns. They're also working in Iraq, which when Bill Wiley, who's behind this organization, was speaking recently in Toronto, he wouldn't say they were working in Iraq, but the Canadian foreign minister just kind of announced it. So now it's public. And who controls data on the missing? This is my question that I leave it with. And who are they serving, right? So this is what's, I kind of foresee this clash of organizations and interests taking place.